Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Glucksmann Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. My name is Dr. Miriam Nighan, and I will be your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can tune in to us on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, on HD Radio, on nyuirish.net/radiohour, and on irishradio.com. So whether you're here in New York City, or in Ireland, or somewhere else further afield, sit back, relax, agus fáilte isteach. For those of you who don't already know, Glucksmann Ireland House is NYU's Centre for Irish and Irish American Studies. Inspired by the vision and philanthropy of Lewis L. Glucksmann and Loretta Brennan Glucksmann, Glucksmann Ireland House NYU has evolved into a vibrant and world-renowned centre for the study of Ireland, Irish America, and the global Irish since our founding in 1993. We're coming to you today from our home, which is an elegant townhouse at Washington Mews and Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. Well, folks, another busy week here in Greenwich Village at 1 Washington Mews. We had our usual array of classes, undergraduate, graduate Irish language classes, and our public events programming in full swing as we approach what will be our spring break week, which is the week of St. Patrick's Day. So just to fill you in a little bit on some of the events we've had in the last week or so, last Saturday we had Irish-born sociologist and genealogist and author of Finding Your Irish Ancestors in New York City, Joe Buggy, here to visit us. We had a packed house here, people who are interested in how one goes about researching their Irish lineage in the wealth. You know, there are a lot of resources here in New York City. So Joe gave a great talk on that, and I will be delighted to have a chat to Joe next week on our show and share some of the information he had to deliver to us while he was here at Glucksmann Ireland House. On Thursday, March 5th, we had our annual Arnall na Féile Pádraig, that is our Irish language concert, which celebrates Lá Éile Fádraig, St. Patrick's Day. And that was coordinated by our senior Irish language lecturer, Pádraig O'Carroll. We had undergraduate and graduate students singing some lovely Irish songs here and warming up the spirit for March 17th. Today, here, continuing our celebration of Seachtain na Gaeilge, and the period of really reflecting on St. Patrick, and I suppose it's the one month of the year here in the United States where people think a lot about being Irish. And with that in mind, we are hosting a Lá Gaeilge, an Irish Language Day, here at Glucksmann Ireland House. It begins at 1 o'clock today and will run till 5 p.m. And some of our Irish language teaching team, Pádraig O'Carroll, Hilary Vicsivna, and some help from Paul Ferris and our visiting Fulbright, Shane O'Rourke. They'll be here doing a fun day of Irish language workshops. So if you're about, there's still room, so please feel free to pop into us and to partake in Lá Gaeilge. Later this evening, we're having our annual Barra O'Donovan lecture, which is named for a beloved advocate of the Irish language in the 10th annual Barra O'Donovan lecture. And it will be delivered by Dr. Fergal Machanrontheg, and he's going to talk about From An Chumann Chúnard to An Lá Dearg, Building Gaelic Communities from the Bottom Up in the North of Ireland. And I am delighted to say that Fergal will come in and have a chat to me here on the Glucksmann Ireland House NYU Radio Hour, and we will be sharing that with you very soon. Tonight, I have the pleasure of attending the Cork Association annual dinner, and two friends of mine who I know are regular listeners to the Glucksmann Ireland House NYU Radio Hour are Bridget and Jim Cagney. They're being honoured tonight with the Frank Carvel Award at the annual Cork dinner. So congratulations, Cohorthachas, Breathe, August Seamus, Jim and Bridget, congratulations, and I look forward to seeing you later tonight at this wonderful celebration. Just to remind you, we do have another open house for our master's program in Irish and Irish American Studies on Friday the 13th from 5 to 7 p.m. And that will be followed by a Blarney Star concert, Noel Hill, will be here playing the concertina, and he will team up with Martin O'Connell on the box accordion. So that will be a fun night here on the 13th. Now, on next Saturday, March 14th at 12 p.m, that's noon, we will be co-sponsoring the annual St. Patrick's Day Mass, which will be held in Irish, and that will be followed by some light food and music. This is going to take place at St. Patrick's Old Cathedral on the corner of Mott and Prince Streets. And Jim Garrity from the New York Irish History Roundtable, and also the historian of St. Patrick's Old Cathedral, is going to come in and have a chat to me about this during the programme here. So sit back, folks, and hear what Jim has to say about what has turned into a really great annual event commemorating St. Patrick in a very historic place for the Irish here in New York City. On Tuesday, February 24th, I mentioned that we were holding our annual gala. It was our third gala, and we honoured two great Irish Americans in Ted Smith and Peter Quinn. Ted is a well-known businessman here in the city, and Peter would be known more recently for his wonderful books. At the event, we had the joy and pleasure of celebrating Pete Hamill, and I wanted to share with you the comments that Pete made at the gala. He always has something interesting to say, and I thought it would be nice for those of you who weren't able to be there in person to hear what Pete had to say at this event. We also recently had another visitor here at Luxman Ireland House in Dr. Mary Louise Coulihan from NUI Galway, formerly known as UCG. Mary Louise shared with us some insights into her pioneering research on women's writing in the early modern period, and it's a really fascinating, important, and really previously underexplored area of inquiry. While Mary Louise was here in New York City, I'm delighted to say that she sat down and had a chat to me for the Luxman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour about her fascinating research on this period. So I'm delighted to be able to share with you that chat with Mary Louise as well. And as usual, it speaks to the dynamic range of visitors and activities held here at Luxman Ireland House. Sitting with Mr. Jim Garrity. I suppose, Jim, you wear multiple hats in terms of the context of me speaking to you today. An active committee member, and correct me as to your exact title currently, with the New York Irish History Roundtable, but you're also very heavily involved in St. Patrick's Old Cathedral. And I suppose it's the combination of those two involvements for you and the intersection, happily to say, with us here at Luxman Ireland House, NYU, that I'm talking to you today about the Irish Language Mass at St. Patrick's Old Cathedral, which will take place on Saturday, March 14th. This is, I believe, Jim, the eighth year that this Mass has taken place. Can you tell me a little bit about the evolution of this gathering?
That is correct. It is our eighth annual Irish Language Mass at Old St. Patrick's, the Basilica of St. Patrick's Old Cathedral, as they call it now, since we got basilica status. When the new pastor came back in 2007 or so, Monsignor Sacano, Donald Sacano, he wanted to try and reconnect the old cathedral with some of its Irish roots. Now, there are not that many people of Irish ancestry living near the cathedral, and there haven't been for many, many years. The neighborhood has gone through a change. It's in Nolita, just north of Little Italy, really, on Mott and Prince Streets. And he wanted to renew the connection of the place with the Irish community. And so we've had to kind of drag the Irish community in from the outer boroughs and from Westchester and Rockland and even New Jersey to have the Mass. The Mass was my idea, based upon the wonderful Irish Masses they do further uptown at the church's name.
It's on 42nd Street, isn't
yes.
it? Around there, yeah.
Yeah. It was the church that...
There's a connection to De Valera.
Yes, he was baptized there.
And shame on me, the name of it is escaping me right now as well. I'm having one of those senior moments.
St. Agnes, right.
Yes. Very good. And that actually traditionally takes place, correct me if I'm not mistaken, on St. Patrick's Day,
on
St.
Patrick's morning before the Mass gathers.
Mm-hmm.
And they do that every year, and they do a beautiful job of it. I'm not usually up early enough to be at it, but, you know.
So, ironically, Monsignor Sicano, who has actually been on the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour, I'm happy to say, talking to us there a few months ago with my colleague, Professor Marion Casey, this non-Irishman was actually the one who came up with this initiative, so to speak, to bring the Irish back in, and you formalized it through the Irish language mass. So, you know, and for those who are, you know, not practicing Catholics, or indeed, heaven forbid, if we have people who are listening who are not Irish and Catholic, and I say that in jest, of course, why was the Irish language component important, Jim? And was that specifically your idea as well, that it would be in the Gaelic language?
It was my idea, and it was my idea because I'm the historian down at All St. Patrick's Cathedral, and I've been so for about 10 years. I've been the vice president for family history of the New York Irish History Roundtable since 2004, so there's a confluence of things happening, and also a member of Glucksman Ireland House, mm-hmm. just about that long. The Irish language fascinated me, not because I can speak it, because I cannot, but I had read that some of the early priests in that parish spoke Gaelic Irish very fluently, and as a matter of fact, they blessed one of the churchyards, a new section of churchyard that was opened. Father Michael O'Gorman blessed a portion of the churchyard with the Vespers prayers in the Irish language. The Irish language was very popular back then in the 1820s amongst the Irish that were here. And a lot of people think, who don't know any better or haven't read any history, that the Irish only arrived here in New York at the potato famine times, 1847 and later. The Irish have been here in New York City since the Dutch. They've been here right from the start.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't be surprised if an Irishman got involved with the American Indian, the Native Americans, before anyone else did, because we've been here a long time.
Mm-hmm.
We've been here a very long time.
And as you know, Jim, Marion Casey is a real font of knowledge on that early and very dynamic, diverse Irish group of people who were here. And if you wouldn't mind, with your historian hat on pertaining to the history of the Basilica of St. Patrick's Old Cathedral, can you tell us a little bit more about some of the highlights or things that jump out at you in terms of the Irish connection between the place and the church as we know it today and the evolution of the communities around it?
Sure, sure. Well, just as an aside, Dr. William J. McNevin was a trustee of the cathedral for a short time, granted, but he was a trustee. He attended trustees meetings. I've gotten to see some of his comments in the trustees minutes when I was allowed to look at them. Isn't always easy, even as a historian, when you have trouble getting into some of the records. You don't have a collar, it's a problem. But nonetheless, William James McNevin was there. There was an enormous class of, again, this is unknown, of Irish merchants who were very, very well-to-do and who were trustees of not only the cathedral but the First Catholic Church in New York, St. Peter's. Dominic Lynch, the Lynch name is still known in the wine industry. He was a wine importer. He had vineyards in Europe, and he imported wines. Andrew Morris, who was, we believe, a Galway man, was the first Catholic man elected to public office in the city of New York. He's buried in our churchyard in an unmarked grave. Someday I'm going to get a marker, a memorial stone or plaque placed there because I really think that we owe it to him. Morris was also a great philanthropist and donated to all of the charities of the city, Catholic or not, in his day.
Is there a way, Jim, in the research you've done and your connections with the Basilica, is there a way to reconstruct the lives of the ordinary parishioners who would have lived in what would have been, we would have come to know as tenement buildings, I think, over time, and in those little streets and alleys that are now high-priced real estate?
Oh, my, you know? The neighborhood has changed. Even in the 10 years since I've been frequenting the place often, the neighborhood has changed so much. Yes, I've been able to do some of that retracing work by looking in some of the sacramental registers, the baptisms, the marriage records. We're just north of the 5 points, which, as you know, was a great area of crime dissolution, and Irish and others were involved. That movie, Gangs of New York, which was panned historically because of its conflating of time periods, did nonetheless tell a story of a real roiling area, an area that was wild and woolly. It was like the wild, wild west right here in New York. And some of our parishioners came up from there. Actually, a Cuban priest, Father Felix Varela, having nothing to do with the Irish, he was a Cuban emigre. He had to leave Cuba because the Spanish government wanted to put him in prison because he was a revolutionary. He wanted a free Cuba. He came to New York at the invite of another Irishman who's a priest, Father John Power, very Reverend Father John Power, who's buried below our cathedral in our extensive catacombs. Father John Power asked Father Varela to come, and he opened several churches down in Lower Manhattan, Transfiguration being one, St. James being another, and both of those churches were very, very Irish churches. The Irish community loved Father Varela. Even though he could speak no Irish, he had a hard time with English, but they loved him.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Now, the event on March the 14th, Saturday, March the 14th, the Irish Language Mass we're discussing, also ties in another church through the celebrant of that Mass on the 14th, Father Andrew O'Connor of St. Mary's Church. Again, that would have been a church that would have historically been frequented by the Irish as
well. Absolutely, absolutely. It was a very Irish church back in those days.
That's down on Grand Street?
It's right? On Grand, yeah. There were rectories on Attorney, but it is on Grand. And it was built in the 1820s. Matter of fact, there was a fire there, an arson fire, where the assailants tied the bell up so that it couldn't be rung. And the church had burned down. They had to rebuild it. And its pastor was so heartbroken at the destruction of his church that he actually, you would say, died of a broken heart. He didn't die of injuries of the fire, but a young man in his 30s, he died soon after that. And he's also buried underneath the old cathedral in the catacombs.
So the annual Mass then, Jim, has, it sounds like it's evolved to quite a festive occasion. Tell me, you know, for people who want the opportunity of attending an Irish language Mass in this very historic cathedral, there's a wonderful opportunity, but that's not all that people are going to buy into on the 14th should they attend the event. Can you tell us a little bit more of the details of the day?
Well, after the Mass, and the Mass is always great, we have some bagpipers doing the procession in, either from the fire department or the police department, one of the Emerald groups. They ring us into the cathedral, and we have the Mass. Then afterwards we have, and this year it will be indoors, thank God, with the weather we've been having, we have an after party with Cayley music, Irish music. Every other year we've had the Washington Square Harp and Shamrock Orchestra from NYU. We're having members of that group this year. The whole group together is not presently taking bookings, but several of the members are coming, so we're going to have great music. We have Irish soda bread. It is not a plastic patty type event. We try not to have people coming with the plastic and gold hats and stuff. We're not into that stuff.
And there's enough of that done on St. Patrick's
Day. Oh my Lord,
if
yes.
If I may say. Yeah. So it's well attended, Jim. It's a popular event.
It is well attended. We'll have the Niall O'Leary dance troupe dancing for us. We'll have the group playing for us. The Washington Square Splinter Group will be playing for us. A good time is always had by all. We'll have coffee, tea, again, soda bread. Other years we've had catered food, but it didn't really fit in with what we were doing. But we've had plenty of people break out dancing to the Cayley music right in the courtyard of the church. But this year it will be in the St. Patrick's Youth Center on Mulberry Street, which has just been renovated, so it's climate controlled, it's beautiful, everything is nice in there.
So after the Mass, people will just stroll over there to the youth center?
They'll walk around the corner. Normally, they would be able to go through the church, but the church is in progress of renovation right now. And that alleyway that goes from Mott to Mulberry is not open. So they'll just have to walk around the historic brick wall that was put up by the Hibernians to protect the church back in the 1830s. they'll get a little history lesson as they walk around the corner.
Wonderful. So again, folks, that is Saturday, March 14th. So that's next Saturday at 12 p.m. in St. Patrick's Old Cathedral, the Basilica of St. Patrick's Old Cathedral on Mott Street between Prince and Houston. That's at high noon, as I mentioned. It is free of charge. Free will contributions are always welcome. And we're delighted here at Luxman Ireland House NYU to partner with this event in terms of celebrating the feast day of St. Patrick through the medium of the Gaelic language and more generally some culture and dance alongside of it as well to mark the occasion.
I would just like to thank Luxman Ireland House and in particular Marion Casey and Patrick O'Carroll for being with us every single year. The eighth year, Patrick will be with us doing readings. He's a great guest. He loves to participate. We really couldn't have started this without help from Ireland House, and we thank you very much.
Well, it's our pleasure. It's beautiful. If anyone hasn't been there, it really is such a beautiful and historic, even the grounds of a gym, when I tend to cycle by it when I have an opportunity, and even from outside, I just find the history of the place speaks to me, even for those who are not as interested or are in the celebration of the feast day as well. It's a great opportunity. Well done on organising this again. And Jim, hopefully we'll have you back again sometime soon to talk more about your fascinating insights into the history of this lovely building.
I'd love to be back with you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And happy St. Patrick's Day.
Happy St. Patrick's.
Obviously delighted to be here in the company of so many people who believe, above all, that there are many ways to be Irish. Glucksman Ireland House, since it began, was dedicated to that proposition. There are Irish people of all religions, and even, I'm shocked, no religion at all. There are straight Irishmen and women, and gay Irishmen and women. There are tall Irish folks and short ones. There are gentle and soft-spoken Irish, and yes, a minority of hammerheads. Luxman Ireland House can find room for all of them in its vision of what it is to be pulsing with the history and the facts and the poetry of Ireland, to try to understand all of them is one of the tasks of GIH, to see them one at a time, to laugh with them in good times and sob with them in times of loss and farewell. Hell, we're Irish, no? It is no accident that so many Irish came to this city across three centuries and stayed. It is, after all, the capital of people who are not like you. No accident, too, that we all mixed with the other strangers. Irishmen fought with Italians for a while and then started marrying them. Some Irishmen will do anything for food. Edible food. The Irish of Tammany Hall opened the doors to strangers for one overriding reason. They could count. And they built a city that we still live in now because enough people were registered in a political party and voted to make the future and then worked at it. The lights are green at the Empire State Building tonight. Not 50 shades of green, but green. And I like to think, we're talking to Joe Lee in the corner over there, wonderful Joe, that the green of the Empire State Building was celebrating the memory of those Irishmen who died putting it into the sky. The complicated tale of all the Irish who came and stayed should be told to all the new immigrants, all those men, women, and children who are becoming our brothers and sisters, husbands or wives. Each of the newcomers will be touched by at least 50, 60 shades of green. Their children will surely deck themselves in red, white, and blue. So we're here because of the people who carried us in here. In my case, as in the case of so many people here tonight, we were carried by tough, smallish people who came and stayed, who didn't find streets paved with gold, but found that they could vote for their leaders on election day, that they could live in a city that respected them, that made them members of unions and members able to get educated in ways that nobody before had done. I'm one of that whole tribe that had the good fortune to be young right after World War II. And when I finally went into the Navy and came out later, I had one of those big government programs that makes so many Tea Party types vomit. It was called the GI Bill of Rights. And it gave the life, it said, Shakespeare is yours too, kid. You know, the great artists are yours too. The great music is yours too. And let us move into the world and make our own mistakes, but live. Live. I think we're the fortunate few who remember enough about where we came from that we will make sure we take the young immigrants by the hand, walk them in, and give them a seat at the table. They're us. We're going to have to remember them for the rest of our lives.
I'm here at Glucksman Ireland House NYU welcoming a visitor to us by way of NUI Galway, the National University of Ireland at UCG as it's formerly known. Dr. Mary Louise Coulihan is here for, I believe, your second visit. It's the second time you were here. Some people who may have attended the Dublin-Bordeaux Letters Conference and the related exhibit curated by Professor Tom Trucks there just over a year ago may have had the opportunity to meet Dr. Mary Louise Coulihan and to hear the fabulous paper she gave as part of that series of interventions, so to speak, on this rich cache of letters as discovered by Tom Trucks. And Tom has been on the programme to talk about that wonderful find he made there, I think it was January 2011 now. So I suppose that was how we first came to meet you, Mary Louise, and that's kind of the reason you're back here again. We were so delighted to come across your research and hear your take on the letters as discovered by Tom. Maybe, and I should say you're affiliated with the Department of English in UCG in NUI Galway,
Can you tell us a little bit about how you got into the world of, I suppose, early modern women's writing? Is the best is that the best way to describe you?
It's a long way. Yes, yeah. Early modern women's writing, really, I think, is my area of specialism. And probably I consider myself an early modernist more than anything else. So I'm probably equally, I suppose, a literary scholar and a historian as well. And the reason that Tom initially got hold of me was because of that interest in early modern women's writing in Ireland in particular. I published a book on early modern women's writing in Ireland a few years ago. But I hadn't really stretched into the 18th century, which is where the Bordeaux-Dublin letters are. So I was just fascinated by the material that Tom had uncovered and by the way that it had connections with the work that I had done on 16th and 17th century literature, on kind of women's literacy, women's production of writing, women's authorship, that kind of stuff. And one of the fascinating things about the material in the Bordeaux-Dublin letters is how many of the letters are by women. And in particular, I think I was really struck by the letters written by servants. And really, I mean, single-handed, I think there's about six letters in the collection that Tom found that are women who are domestics working in Irish families in Bordeaux. And those six letters are probably the only six we know of in that period for women of that class.
Wow.
And so the discovery almost single-handedly overturns a lot of assumptions that would have been made, not just about women's ability to write, but about the lower classes' ability to write at the time, in the middle of the 1700s. So that's got me very interested in kind of literacy and women's production in the 18th century. But I suppose my own firm work really is in 16th and 17th century writing.
So I'm intrigued as to how you initially got into that. Will you indulge me and tell me a little bit about your journey?
Gosh, I probably better not put a year on it now. I did my master's in Renaissance literature, which is another term for early modern, in Oxford. And while I was there, I met two women who were setting up a project on women's manuscripts of the 16th and 17th centuries in England. And they got funding for the project, which became known as the Perdita Project, after Shakespeare's character Perdita, who's lost and then found. And what they were interested in doing was in tracking, identifying manuscripts that had been compiled by women in the 16th and 17th centuries. And this, I suppose I better put a date on it now, would have been kind of mid-1990s. And it was a time when scholars in English literature were starting to realise that they'd overlooked, maybe, or not taken seriously enough, manuscript writings. So writings that were circulated in handwritten form rather than printed in the 16th and 17th century.
And are you talking then basically about writing, would that be religious orders like nuns writing, or not confined to that at all?
A whole lot, not especially when you look at it in an English context, because that period is a period immediately after, well, during and after the Protestant Reformation. And one of the big things that I think often gets underestimated with the Protestant Reformation is that one of its big innovations is the idea that people, if they're going to be good, godly people, need to read the Bible themselves and need to figure out what God is saying to them directly. And if you're going to tell people they should read the Bible themselves, you have to teach them how to read. And if you're going to tell mothers that they need to educate their kids, then mothers have to be able to write and be able to educate their kids. So really the Protestant Reformation causes a revolution in literacy across early modern Europe. And in particular, as we know, because it took hold in England much more than it did for the majority in Ireland, it means that it became a legitimate reason to start writing, to start articulating and expressing your own ideas. And of course, the starting point is God, is religion. But it very quickly becomes much richer and more layered than that. So it's also the period, the 17th century, when autobiography as a form comes into being. That stems from this originally religious impulse, where if people are being encouraged to think about what's my relationship with God, how am I responding to God, then they're having to turn in on themselves and think about who am I, what is myself, and start articulating that. So it's the great period when autobiography as a form really comes into being as well.
So if, as you kind of nicely put it, you know, the Reformation doesn't have the same impact in Ireland as it does in the neighbouring island, how does that translate in terms of the sources for what you were interested in the Irish context? Is it more of a challenge, I imagine?
It is. Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, one of my contentions, I suppose, about Ireland in this period would be that it's a very multicultural, multilingual place, and that maybe we haven't always taken that on board as much as we should. And so the research that I did for my book was really quite archival research, trying to recover what kinds of writing were produced by women in the period, regardless really of language or language tradition. So my parameters were anything that's produced by a woman who was born in Ireland or who was residing in Ireland in the period. because some people would have been born in Ireland and left as refugees for Spain for political reasons. Some people would have been wives and daughters of settlers, of English colonial settlers who had travelled over to Ireland. So really I had very broad set of parameters, and that meant that I could include Irish language literary production as well as English language production. And what I found was, so there's kind of the autobiography, which is being written by English women who come to Ireland, and of course they're being exposed to a new country, and all of those settler experiences are things that they want to articulate. There are letters being written, not only from Ireland to England, but from Ireland to the continent where many refugees have gone. There are petition letters being written in Spain by Irish women who find themselves in Spain bereft for various reasons. And the King of Spain had a particular deal for the Irish, that if they could prove they were Catholic and noble, of noble lineage, and that they had suffered, they had made a contribution to the Counter-Reformation cause, then they could qualify for a Spanish pension. So there's a ton of material that we've only begun to scratch the surface of, which is petition letters by men and women to the King of Spain looking for this pension, trying to narrate a version of themselves that conforms to what you need to be in order to get this money.
And are they predominantly in Spanish?
They're in Spanish, exactly. Wow. So that's, I guess, what I mean by multilingual. So you don't just have what we might expect, Irish language and English language material. You have material in Castilian Spanish. There's also very little surviving, but there is some surviving writing in Latin by women of the period. And so it's not only different languages, but different traditions and different motivations for writing. You know, I mean, the authors of petition letters in Spanish to the King of Spain aren't necessarily writing because they feel they want to be successful writers, as you might think of today. They have very pragmatic reasons. Mm-hmm. They have to turn to writing. And that's part of what I'm interested in as well, is the social context for literary production in its broadest sense, literary in its broadest sense, and the different ways that people are impelled to present themselves and to develop personas for themselves in writing, and to what ends they're doing so.
So it really, you know, is pushing you in terms of locating the individual writing and the context of the production of the document within the broader historical context, you know, as you say, the motivation.
What's driving them to write, because in a lot of cases, I mean, if you're looking at women's writing in early modern Ireland, there really is very little writing that would conform to what we might think of traditionally as being literary, in the sense, you know, there's no playwright. Mm-hmm. You know, the people aren't writing drama, largely because there's just no space. There's too much turmoil going on to have the kind of the privileged space for that kind of writing. But there are people producing poetry. There are people writing history. There are people writing petitions. There are people writing accounts of themselves in various different forms. And often it's circumstances that drive them to writing, rather than writing being a choice in the way that we might expect today, nowadays in the 21st century, that someone would choose to be a writer or has always fancied trying out a novel. It's a very, very different situation in the 16th and 17th centuries, where people come to writing because they have to in a lot of ways.
The whole sphere of literature as we know it today is relatively new when you place it in that context.
I'm not sure that it's relatively new. I think there's been a big development in the last kind of 10, 20 years. Literary scholars have shifted their thinking of what literature with a capital L is. And that has dovetailed with people who are interested in writing that's produced by ordinary people or the lower social classes or by women or all of those categories. So that means that instead of the traditional sense of the literary would have included poetry, drama and fiction, really there's been an expansion in the last 10, 20 years to think of all forms of writing. So I guess letters are really a very good example, mm-hmm. diaries, mm-hmm. those kinds of things that wouldn't have traditionally been considered mm-hmm. literary with a capital L. And that allows us really a window into a much more common, conventional, ordinary experience of literature and of writing than we would have had if we're just interested in the Shakespeare's, say.
You know, one of the things I think, especially when we think of this period and a little bit, you know, into the 18th and 19th century as well, we're aware of, or at least we tend to be conscious of, the oral tradition mm-hmm. in the Irish context. And I'm wondering how that impedes or enriches your scholarship when some things must be written down, but how is the richness of the oral tradition, if it is as rich as we think mm-hmm. it is, impacting on your kind of lens on literacy or the women's literature?
Well, you're right to say impede and enrich. It's probably both. Once you get before 1700, there's really very little surviving of the oral tradition. And in fact, the kind of the female authored poems that we know of or songs that we know of really only get written down at the very beginning of the 1700s, the very beginning of the 18th century. I mean, that's not only a matter of gender, it's also a matter of class. That elite literary culture, elite Gaelic Irish literary culture, was written down, but even that really came from an oral performance tradition. So even kind of the bardic poetry that people might have heard about, the kind of very elite male professional forms of poetry, were designed to be performed rather than to be written down. Although because they were elite, they were written down. It's really only when you get to the end of the period that I'm working on that people start writing down more popular forms, more vernacular forms of composition, of poetry, of song. I think that's really because the writing's on the wall at that point for Irish Gaelic culture. And so people who are capable of writing it down want to quickly write down as much as they can so that it's preserved in some kind of a form. So there's evidence to suggest that there would have been a lot more surviving material, that there would have been a lot more material, but that it doesn't survive, mm-hmm. that the attrition rates, probably because it was an oral tradition, that a lot of it just didn't survive. It wasn't preserved in that kind of a way. It would have been transmitted orally from generation to generation. And as that particular culture and the language start going into decline, then the mechanisms for transmitting it and for preserving it orally start to decline as well.
So it strikes me in what you're describing that the topic of your book and indeed the research projects that you're working on today are the product of intense archival research and cross-checking and an evolution of theses over time, mm-hmm. right? Because you're trying to reconstruct things, I would imagine, from quite disparate sources.
Mm-hmm.
What were your richest areas of source material for this kind of research? Or?
Gosh, it varies quite a lot. What are my richest sources? I started off in the Irish language stuff, actually, from the footnote of a monumental and classic book published in the 90s by Brandon O'Buchla, the late Brandon O'Buchla, called Aisling Lair. And at that time, I was just working on English women's writing, but had, I suppose, an interest in early modern Ireland, so was reading the book. And there was a footnote in it that referred me to a poem by a woman called Kathleen Love, which intrigued me, and it had the reference, which is why good scholars always give references. Mm. But O'Buchla hadn't actually written about the poem. It was just a footnote reference that caught my eye. And the reference was to a manuscript in Maynooth. So the next time I was in the area, I went to Maynooth Library and looked at the manuscript. They were great there. And it turned out that there were 5 poems in that manuscript attributed to this woman, Kathleen Love. And the manuscript was, in fact, a family poem book associated with the O'Briens of Thomond, which would be kind of present-day County Clare. And the O'Briens were the big chieftains of that area. So the poem book was a collection of poems that were related to the O'Briens and their extended family, which is how these 5 songs or poems came to be written down and came to be preserved.
So again, you're talking about a particular stratum of social class,
yeah.
when you're talking at that level. And for the benefit of our listeners who may, you know, when you say the word manuscript, you're not talking necessarily of things that rival the Book of Kells in terms of their aesthetics or like
what do these actually look like?
Can you describe them? I guess they vary as
they
well.
They do vary, but generally you're talking about bound volumes. But the bindings could be 19th century bindings that, you know, librarians or whatever have put on, in mm-hmm. which case you don't get much sense of what they would have originally looked like. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes you'd get bindings that are vellum, so kind of old-fashioned forms of leather, if they're original bindings. If they're original, sometimes you'll find little ribbons that are keeping the 2 covers tied together. That's if you're lucky and you get the original binding. But an awful lot of this material would now be in, you know, one of the great libraries of the world. So, I mean, in the States, I suppose, New York Public Library has a certain number of them. The Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington, D.C., the Huntington Library in California have big collections of this kind of stuff. And really, in order to have got into those libraries, someone at some stage is likely to have rebound them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's rare enough to find them in their original binding. But it's clear that something like that, kind of what I was describing, the family poem book, would be a dúnara, is the Irish term for it, was deliberately compiled mm-hmm. as a volume and as a binding. In terms of what the pages look like mm-hmm. and the page layout, you wouldn't have anything like the illuminated manuscripts.
Mm-hmm.
They're meant to be much more usable volumes than that, where something like the Book of Kells was clearly always intended for display
mm-hmm.
and as an aesthetic achievement, as an object, an art object mm-hmm. in and of itself. These would tend not to have illustrations at all and would probably, you know, if they're collections of poetry, they would have a layout that is the layout of a poem. and they'd have a title, but that would be about it in terms of anything that's aesthetic.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested, you know, if you wouldn't mind talking a little bit about those traditional roles of Gaelic culture, the filla, the keening. Is it just by the occasional or more frequent writing down that you described in terms of the Gaelic order, a notion of things passing and that certain things are written down? Is that how you're getting at those elements of the Gaelic culture that we refer to today?
I suppose so. I mean, obviously, I'm kind of on the coattails of the real experts in Irish manuscripts. So, I mean, one of the people who's done superb work in this area is Maureen Egunacu, whose work is in the Field Day Anthology. If people are interested in Irish women's writing, the Field Day Anthology, volumes 4 and 5, has women's writing in it. And there's, I suppose it's received a lot of attention for the contemporary 20th century material that's in it, but there's some really amazing stuff in from the earlier periods too. And one of the things that Maureen managed to uncover were the references, although there may not be actual material or poems by women predating the 16th century, there are references to women as poets, as lower class poets and lower class versifiers, and to, you know, professional poets slagging them off, essentially, because the professional poet had to undergo 7 years training in all kinds of very elaborate syllabic meters. So the meters of the poetry were designed around the numbers of syllables and the different classes of different groups of consonants, and they all had to cohere with each other in a really very sophisticated way. And I don't think there's really very little evidence of women engaged in that kind of stuff at all. I mean, it was a professional male cast who engaged in that. But they complained about lower class versifiers, more popular vernacular versifiers who wouldn't have been trained in syllabic meters. And, you know, I suppose the equivalent of balladeers in the 18th century, you know, those kind of popular verse forms.
No one has been able to, they haven't been recorded more fully.
No, not yet. You know, you never know, new things are coming to light all the time, and the more you let people know about this stuff, the more people keep an eye out for it. But there are, you know, complaints about, there are people who complain about, you know, I hate a poet company that includes a woman, which suggests, of course, that there were poet companies that included women who were travelling around. Alan Fletcher, I think, has done a bit of work on this as well for the medieval period. So there is evidence that there were more popular versifiers and that women were amongst them. But really it's only towards the end of the period. I mean, I suppose the quina, the keen, is a form that people would probably be more familiar with, that's very much associated with women. The idea of the mourning song, the lament on the death of whomever it may be, probably the most famous is Cuina Arti Lira, Eileen Dulfney Connell's one. But that's a tradition that went back centuries before Eileen Dulfney Connell, and some of the earliest examples of poems by women that we have are these quinta, or keens. But they would have been orally performed, they would have been part of that more popular tradition. The meter that we have for those early poems is in the quina meter. It's much more about stressed vowels. So rather than sticking rigidly to syllables, that you maintain a certain rhyme scheme at the end of each line, and once you have that same rhyme scheme at the end of each line, that gives you freedom to do what you like with sounds in the rest of the poem or the song.
At the moment, we haven't talked about your current project, your co-investigator on women's poetry 1400 to 1800 in English, Gaelic, Scots Gaelic and Welsh. Can you tell us a little bit about that project? It sounds fascinating.
Sure, that's one of two projects that I'm involved with at the moment. That particular one is run out of Aberystwyth University in Wales, and it's a collaboration between myself, some colleagues in Aberystwyth, and some colleagues in Edinburgh. And what we're trying to do is two things, that we will produce an anthology and also a comparative critical study of women's poetry specifically between 1400 and 1800, produced in Irish Gaelic, in Scots Gaelic, in Lowland Scots, and in Welsh. And really the idea is to try and shift the emphasis that there has been when it comes to scholars of early modern women's writing on the islands of Britain and Ireland, to focus on Anglophone English language material, and instead to kind of broaden that out and look at the other vernacular languages and to give us a situation in which we can compare them. Because one of the problems, of course, at doing this kind of work has been that no single scholar really has the language skills or indeed the historian skills to be able to do this for all of those vernacular languages. But if you collaborate and get an expert in early modern Welsh and an expert in early modern Irish and Scots Gaelic, then you can start juxtaposing the material that there is together and start generating, hopefully, new questions about how they're relating to each other.
Have you any insights? Is it premature to ask you? Yeah.
It's a bit early. I mean, we've been doing kind of, what kind of preliminary results do we have? We don't have the material ready yet. What does seem, unfortunately, to be the case is that the Welsh and Scots Gaelic material far outweighs the surviving material from Ireland or from Lowland Scots. So in the period 1400 to 1800, there's about 300-350 Scots Gaelic poems by women and about 200 Welsh, and there's about 50 Irish. And that's partly to do with how history plays out, because in Irish Gaelic and Scots Gaelic would have been pretty much the same language until the middle of the 1500s. And one of the big differences is that in Ireland, of course, there's the Tudor conquest. There's a very definite programme of colonisation going on, which doesn't happen in Scotland. The other thing is that a number of Scottish Gaelic chiefs accepted the ideas of the Reformation and took on board the Protestant religion, which meant that they weren't persecuted in the same way, and meant that Gaelic culture in Scotland had a greater longevity. It thrived for much longer than Irish Gaelic culture had. So I was talking earlier about oral transmission of songs by women. It's clear from the Scots Gaelic case that that's why we have so much more material surviving in the Scots Gaelic context. It's because the culture itself thrived and continued for much longer, and the songs, along with the stories, their backstories, the original female composers of those songs, were transmitted over time. Mm. So that's why we have a big difference there. But, you know, the other kinds of things we want to be looking at are, we want to kind of compare Bardic culture and compare, you know, can we speak about a pan-Celtic culture mm-hmm. in the period? Are the genres the same, or are there very unique genres to each of the countries? So those are the kinds of questions we're hoping to be able to answer.
And tell us about the other project you're working on.
The other project that I'm working on is called RECIRC for short. It's short for the Reception and Circulation of Early Modern Women's Writing from 1550 to 1700. So RECIRC really is a shift for me away from the archival recovery of writing produced by women to looking at the impact that it made, its reception. So for women who did produce writing, where did it go? How were their texts circulated? Who read them? How were they read? What kind of impact did they make? Did the fact that they were female authored texts make a difference to contemporaries or not? So those are the kinds of questions I'm asking on that project, and that's a big project. That's really the central thing I'm doing at the moment. I've got a team of 5 postdoctoral researchers working with me. We've just begun that project, and we've got funding from the European Research Council to keep that going for the next 5 years. So that's a much bigger scale project, and it's not focused solely on, it includes Irish women, but it's focused on kind of the English speaking world and writers who are not English but who were read in English mm-hmm. or were received in the English speaking world in the early modern period, so from 1550 to 1700.
You teach in the English department mm-hmm. in Galway. How do your graduate and undergraduate students engage with these mm-hmm. ideas? Is there a lot of interest?
There is a fair bit of interest, yeah. It depends. I mean, there's a whole host of different ways that you can present it to them. Mm-hmm. So some of the material I have presented in the past in the context of literature of the civil wars of the 17th century, and so looking at women's writing alongside other writing that's produced in the time and responding to warfare. Other material, I've looked at something like the letters associated with the Bordeaux-Dublin letters. I've taught them in a class in the context of 18th century epistolary fiction, so the rise of the novel that's structured around letters, and so juxtaposing fictional letters by servant girls with real letters mm-hmm. by servant girls and seeing what kinds of questions that throws up, which there was great enthusiasm for. And then in other senses, sometimes we just teach the straightforward survey of, you know, the kind of straightforward undergraduate course, which is a survey of literature, and you sneak in examples of this kind of stuff mm-hmm. as context as well. And, you know, the canon of literature is shifting all the time as well. So kind of a course that might have been taught, say, 30 years ago on Renaissance literature might have included primarily Shakespeare and John Milton, whereas nowadays it includes all kinds of other writers, including women. And probably the best example of that in this context would be a writer like Catherine Phillips, who's become really a very important canonical figure in her own right now in the way that scholars talk about the 17th century. She was an Anglo-Welsh poet and playwright, but she spent a year living in Dublin in the 1660s. where her greatest literary successes occurred. She had a play performed in Dublin, and that enabled her to go on into print, and she wrote poetry. She kind of insinuated herself into the Dublin court, so she wrote poetry about all of the aristocrats there. So she's very important and interesting from an Irish perspective as well. And I'd say it's probably quite common now in those kinds of big survey, the great books courses, I suppose is what they're called in the States, that a writer like Catherine Phillips would be included straightforwardly as one of the great writers of that period now.
Mm. Well, listen, the projects are fascinating, and I hope that it's not too long before we'll have you back again to hear more about the results of some of these research initiatives. Are fantastic. Thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure to have you here, and hopefully, as I said, we'll see you again.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Grofina Margaret.
I'm John Waters. I'm the director of the Irish and Irish American Studies Master's Program at NYU. Our MA program is an interdisciplinary MA program and a transdisciplinary MA program. We are able to work with students who come to study Irish literature, to study Irish history, to study Irish music, to study Irish culture. All of them find a really dynamic home for their passions and their interests here at Glucksman Ireland House. We're based in a landmark building on Washington Mews, which is a picturesque, quaint street at the very bottom of Fifth Avenue, right across the street from the Washington Square Arch. So we're in a very dynamic physical location, but we're also host to a dynamic internal energy.
The Irish experience is actually a key part of understanding the ethnic experience of New York City and the growth of the city and the development of the city into what it is today.
We're committed to the idea that a very large part of Irish historical experience has taken place outside of Ireland. We think we've actually fashioned a lens for the study of the Irish experience here in New York that really wouldn't be available anyplace else in the world. The majority of our courses are offered between 6 and 9 in the evening here at Ireland House. And that enables people who are working full-time to pursue the degree by doing one or two courses a semester. It's a challenge to be a graduate student today. There's no doubt about that. We're now actually in a position to give financial support for up to 50% of financial aid to students pursuing the program either full-time or part-time. And we're really excited about that because we think people with the passion deserve that kind of support.
We're coming towards the end of the programme. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan, and I want to thank you for listening to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. I'll be back again next Saturday, same time, on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, on HD Radio, on nyuirish.net/radiohour, and at irishradio.com. In the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch with me or my co-producer, Jamie Sweeney, our email address is ireland.house@nyu.edu. If you'd like to hear this program again, please go to nyuirish.net/radiohour. Stay tuned for the Adrian Flannery Show up next on WBNJ 1160 AM. And for those of you listening to irishradio.com, do stay with us till noon. Have a lovely weekend. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Slán agus fanacht.